distributing the Future broadcast June 19th, 2006, playing with location.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. We've just returned from the Wear 2.0 conference in San Jose, California. Next week, you'll hear parts of some of the sessions. This week, you'll hear an interview with the Placial team about the People's Atlas site. We visit the Wear Fair, the second night of the conference, and speak with exhibitors. Greg Treffry and Kevin Slavin talk to Brady Forrest about games, and we play Pixie Hunt with Microsoft's Jordan Schwartz. It's an old Abbott and Costello routine. Where are you going? Yes. No, I'm asking you, where are you going? That's right, I am. You are what? I'm going to where? So when you get on the airplane and you ask them to fly you to where? No, I ask them to fly me to San Jose. Then I take a cab to where? Anyways, to be more clear, we're talking about the second Wear 2.0 conference held this year in San Jose at the Fairmont. To help understand location-based services, we talked with some of the folks from Placial. There are lots of ways to organize information. Chris Goad explains that we already identify our experiences with places. Suppose you want to tag experiences you shared with people you went to school with. Goad says,
and all these sites that are, you know, your classmates and so on, those are based on a common location. That's an aspect of place, that it's a place that's an anchor for a conversation.
A place can be an anchor for a conversation, but is that really a geographic tie? Jason Wilson says it's just part of his everyday journey through life.
Whenever I go anywhere, if I'm walking, driving, flying, looking at a map, looking at pictures, reading a magazine, reading a book about somewhere that I've been, I can't stop myself from being like, oh, that's the place where, like, I lost my shoe in the gutter, or that's the place where the dog almost bit my friend. That annotated three-dimensional world totally exists for me inside my head.
Jacob Wilson adds to Jason's point and says that on their site, the information comes from locals who want to share.
It's sort of the locals, the mavens of their local culture, whether it be urban or whether it be the organic farm mapping user on Placial, the person who really takes pride in their knowledge of place and just wants to share it.
Jason Wilson says that people aren't just posting about one neighborhood. Often people post about a journey they've taken.
This woman said, oh, thank you so much for the site. I love it. We're doing this road trip across the country to go visit all of the old homesteads from our family lineage, and we've mapped it out on Placial as a roadmap to get there. Then we're going to document it with the photos once we're there. I thank you so much that we can now leave this for our grandchildren. It's a totally unexpected kind of use case, but it's one that really has stuck with me.
So you can see why people might want to record the things they do in life, but why would anyone else want to read what they post? Diane Eisner suggests a practical reason you might want to check out what people have to say about a particular area.
If I'm going to move into a house, I could know what's going on around the neighborhood or look at that house over time. Or it's not just moving, it's I'm going to be in that neighborhood, my kid's going to a new school, I got a new job. Lots of reasons to be introduced to new neighborhoods, and so this is a good way to dig down into the deep content of where you're going to be.
There are sites where you get overwhelmed with information. There are just too many dots on the map. Jason Wilson explains how Placial uses pivot points to keep from overwhelming you with information.
You start off in some kind of context. You're always within a context on Placial. So you start off really at a city level. So first you're filtering down to the city. You can see what's recently been added. So your time span is this certain kind of a filter and a context. From there, you pivot around to a certain user. So you're looking at the information from that particular user. From there, you can pivot off of one of their tags or off of one of their places, and you can see the other things that are related. We show very few places at any given time. You always have to kind of take these intentional steps along these pivot points. It's never just this big flood of stuff.
There's something contagious about hanging out with these people and talking about their site. You can hear that they spend a lot of time checking out how people are using Placial. It's not always in ways that they've anticipated.
That kind of surprised me because I really thought it would be more of an urban slant, city culture sort of a thing. So that one was a little offbeat. I tend to think that people in the city are more connected, but that's not the case.
There's a map of, I guess, railway switches. I don't know the terminology.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Just like someone, right. Some railway enthusiast went around and mapped the switches around his area.
Added 100 of them, yeah, right, in his
by
neighborhood.
By brand and by type and voltage, yeah, and whatever.
Actually, I have met railway enthusiasts, and they are really intense.
Well, the Alaska John guy also like started off that way.
His railroad stuff. Shark, what was it? The dolphin trail, the dolphin's path through an ocean or something from the marine biologist student. Weddings, people mapping their weddings. That was a pretty interesting, weird angle that I hadn't really thought of before.
We've seen a couple history teachers using it with their classes. So give out an assignment to all their students, like, okay, go make a map of the civil rights history, civil rights movement. And so, you know, one day we saw like 30 civil rights maps come up all at once.
Placial recognizes that they aren't the only site in this space and that users might want to take their data from one site to another. Goad explains that users might also want to grow the vocabulary used to describe their data. Goad explains how the infrastructure supports that.
The infrastructure has been built on RDF, and the reason for that is that we want to be able to introduce, not us introduce, but our users introduce their own vocabularies for different kinds of places. So for surf spots, for example, you want to say things about swells and whatnot. And you know, if you're a marine biologist, there are billion things that are specialized to you that you want to say, express about your sighting of a marine mammal or whatever it might be. So we will be opening up the capability for users to introduce their own vocabularies.
Eisner agrees with the value of the technology on which Placial is built, but for her, the true value is in what the site enables.
It's really about sharing your experiences related to place. For most people, that's about sharing local experience because that's what they know, but it's about sharing place. At the heart of it all, that's what it is. That's everything we're enabling.
Now that you've been introduced to one team working on a location-based service, here are a few more. We walked around the Ware Fair and asked some of the exhibitors to tell us who they are and what they're showing.
My name's Gina Bianchini. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Ning. We are showing our platform for creating and sharing social web applications. So we have 22 example applications or applications that we seeded the platform with, ranging from map mashups and photo maps to restaurant reviews with maps, to a marketplace and a group application, a family application, that anyone can come along and with a click of a button create their own copy and basically run it. Each of these applications, though, are fully programmable. We basically offer anybody the opportunity to go down into the source code and change not only the look and the feel, but also the behavior of the application itself. So for example, if you don't like the way that we present restaurant reviews or the algorithm that we use for popularity on our example app, you can go in and change it and make it whatever it is that you want. If you want to, you can create essentially more of a proprietary software model on top of Ning where you hide your source code. You can also mask your domain name. So you can actually mask the subdomain of Ning with www.paloaltorestaurants.com. You can also buy more storage, more bandwidth. So you can really actually, and then you can actually also buy into the option to run your own ads. And we're perfectly happy with people doing that. So you can really actually run a full business on top of Ning. Fabrizio Zerardi down in Brazil actually created this cchits.ning.com, which is a directory of all the Creative Commons music. And it plays, each song plays in a flash player within the application. And that was something that was created from the ground up on Ning.
I'm Steve Morris. I'm the president of the MLB company, and we build small unmanned aircraft, little spy planes, and we use these to collect live video imagery, and we also take high-resolution digital photographs to make maps that are geo-referenced. This airplane has a 7-foot wingspan, but it only weighs 20 pounds, and so it's really, you know, smaller than many model airplanes out there, and it can fly for 6 hours. It can fly 200 miles with between refilling the fuel tank. It flies autonomously with onboard computer, GPS, and gyros, so you have to be within 10 miles in order to redirect the airplane. But once you give it a mission profile, it will execute the entire mission hands-off, including takeoff and landing. A lot of the work that we've been doing in this area has been experimental with permission from the FAA, but we can't just go out and do it commercially in the United States right now. We've done many examples where we use more than one airplane to image an area at the same time, but even just one airplane alone can cover, oh, about 100 square miles a day. Well, we're getting very high-resolution data taken at low altitude, so the color saturation is good. And by high resolution, typically 3 inches per pixel, or in some cases even higher. And we can get that data almost on demand. We can send the airplanes out and image a major city in, you know, less than a day, and do that maybe every hour if we use 10 or more airplanes.
My name is Scott Miniman. I'm from Anomie Labs. And we're 2.0 demoing our Spinny Table, which is running an application called the Geo Explorer, which lets you kind of start from a blue marble view of the globe and zoom into anywhere, basically at a resolution where you can see whether there's a car in your driveway. And you navigate with this particular device by tilting a tabletop and spinning a tabletop. So you spin in by spinning the tabletop clockwise and spin and zoom out by spinning the tabletop counterclockwise, and panning and tilting is just leaning the table in one direction or another, wherever you want to go. Tilting the tabletop, well, you kind of know when you tilt the tabletop that something's going to slide to the side that's lower. So when you do that with our table, it's exactly what happens. And so the minute you walk up to the table, you immediately recognize how to use it. There's no learning curve. There's no figuring it out. It's just you get it immediately. And when there's groups of people, there's no turn-taking, like, oh, give me the mouse so that I can show you where my house is. It's more, you know, I just grab my edge of the table and start steering. When there's kids around it, they actually often sometimes are kind of wrestling for the table to, you know, to go see Disneyland versus, you know, go see Six Flags.
Where was not all about fun and games? Well, actually, it kind of was. Before this year's conference, program co-chair Brady Forrest talked to Greg Trefry and Kevin Slavin about mobile gaming. As in many areas of technology, it's the gamers that push the boundaries. Slavin explains.
I think one of the things that's happened in what's really an emerging field is that location-based has come to be equated with geographic information, and that's not necessarily, you know, the full capabilities that we can get to. And the really interesting things that are happening in terms of location-based games are games that go beyond simply, you know, using latitudinal and longitudinal information, and, you know, start to use things like the time of day, start to use things like sunlight, or start to use things like the lens of the camera, which can recognize where it is, that maybe there's something in particular that you're seeing right where you are. It's not necessarily that you happen to be at this point on the Earth, it's that you happen to be at the right place at the right time, and that there's a lot of ways to determine that. And, you know, we're sort of interested in how to unlock the capabilities within phones, for example, that they can understand what they hear, that they can understand what they see, that they can communicate with everybody we know. It's not necessarily latitude and longitude. What's important is, are our friends nearby? I think the thing to really look for, the thing that's really going to be the most powerful, are going to be the games that really emphasize the social elements, things that are based on the proximity of other people who are playing, for example. So things like Bot Fighters that came out of It's Alive in Sweden, or things like Mogi Mogi that came out of a collaboration between some French researchers and Japanese, that the integration of other people and all the ways that we can do that, that's really going to make the most compelling game experiences as they do in real life. If you look at Japan and Korea specifically, there's a tremendous push towards, you know, real locatability in mobile phones. Within Japan, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it's somewhere around 50% of all current phones are GPS, like really either fully GPS or AGPS. And I think that's mandated at 100% by like 2007, which is like, you know, whatever, 6 months away. That allows a totally different type of experience, right? Because otherwise you're bound to, you know, TDOA locatability, you're bound to like cell ID, which is really pretty limiting in terms of what you can do. Basically, GPS unlocks, you know, a whole set of things that you can do that are really, really powerful. That said, I think there are some imaginative ways to use TDOA and cell ID. If you look at the stuff that the Blister guys have done, the Canadian company Blister have done, they did Swordfish and Torpedo Bay, and that you don't necessarily need GPS to do some really interesting stuff. But I think that the race is really going to be run in Japan and Korea in terms of proper location-based games on the handset. If you don't have GPS or AGPS, then you have a problem on the revenue side, which is that most countries, including the United States, you're going to have to pay on every location lookup, right? And so now you have like a real game design problem, which is that you're disincentivized to play actively. The more times you basically ping for a location, the more you're going to have to pay to play the game. You know, you're never going to have a payment model for that that's really going to be that enticing for people. Once you move to a GPS or AGPS model, then the people who are going to play these games are the people who play games. You know, asking who plays games is like asking who goes to the movies. The answer is always everyone, but then different people go to different movies, and different people will play different games. The challenge with big games and location-based games is to make games that use physical information and use location, but can still be played out in a casual way. And then, you know, will people pay a couple bucks a month? It seems like it. You know, we'll see. If you go to any ad agency, what they're doing is they're looking for something, anything to do besides a 30-second ad, and they're looking for anything that can actually engage people and broadcast out in public space. Some of the clients that have done that are tech companies, you know, are the Nokias and the Quests, Microsofts of the world. But then, you know, I think what we're seeing is that, you know, a lot of very different kinds of companies have recognized that this is an emerging and really, really valuable form of entertainment. So you see companies like Palladium Shoes is running a big game based off geocaching. Jeep sponsored a variation of geocaching for a long time. Hasbro did Monopoly Live in London. Northwest Airlines did something in Tokyo. It's very, very different types of companies are making these happen. Within that, some are going to be good, some are going to be bad, just as sure as, you know, there's a couple of good ads on TV and a lot of them are terrible. It really comes down to whether they're going to take the time to really make game design one of the strong elements of the game, you know, that it's not just an afterthought. One of the goals with big games in general is to get people to, you know, sort of have a different set of criteria for the space that they're in. The example we always use is that, like, you know, some woman sits down and decides that this is a one-way street or, you know, it's alternate side of street parking or this and that, and there's all these criteria that are applied to how the street's going to be used, and then you get some kid with a skateboard, and all they care about is whether it's an incline, decline, bumpy, or smooth, and that's a totally different set of criteria, and they use location completely differently than it was intended. And what we're trying to do is basically give totally different sets of criteria. And if the phone is understood as a tool to change what the world around you can do, then that's really, really powerful. It's not just a thing of communicating with other people. It's actually a question of changing how you use the city itself.
The night before the conference, about 50 attendees gathered to play a camera phone scavenger game called Pixie Hunt. Jordan Schwartz, a program manager for Microsoft in their digital photography group, explains the game before sending the teams out to the street armed with a GPS puck and a camera phone.
The object of Pixie Hunt is to go out and take some pictures of you and your team doing things and of things around just around walking distance of this area. I'm handing out a list of the tasks that you'll be completing on paper, and they're also all on your phone. They've been downloaded from a server. Each time you take a photo against one of the tasks, it gets uploaded to Flickr, and then it gets downloaded onto everyone else's phone so they can see what they're up against in real time. The phone will keep score for you. You get extra points for being first, so you get basically 10 points for each task. There are a few, you get 24. You get an extra 5 points for being the first one to complete a task. And then there are a few at the end that have bonus points for taking a particularly good picture.
With those instructions, the teams hit the street. I tagged along with the OSGeo team, and they quickly worked their way down some of the easier tasks. Everyone quickly got into the spirit of the game, and they stopped in a sushi restaurant to complete one task and realized that if the waitress would lend them her apron, they could also complete the challenge of wearing the clothes of a stranger. They encouraged her to pose with them. Outside the next restaurant, they figured that if one of them took off his shoes and socks, they'd be kicked out, thereby completing another task.
Well, let me just take my socks off, dude. That would gross him out. Okay, get the freaking thing loaded.
Okay, where's a bug? I've been looking for bugs.
This is the need not apply one, right? Okay, just the slap them.
I'll stand here at the door, and you'll be refusing me, okay?
That's really good.
Oh, beautiful.
You look
thank
really
you.
Good.
No sooner had they completed that job than they noticed an approaching light rail train. If they ran to catch it, they could knock off yet another task and get more points. They attracted the attention of people actually waiting for the train, and one of them had a tattoo. If only she'd agree to get her picture taken, they could cross off that challenge as well.
You have a tattoo?
Yeah, I got a tattoo.
Do you? Come here. Come here. We need a picture of you with a tattoo.
Don't help them. Where's my money at? Can I get some money?
You get $5. You with a tattoo.
Tattoo
too. No, two things. Tattoo, and then you need to hand the rose to him.
I headed back to the command center and asked Schwartz why he created this game.
I don't have a television. I get sick of my computer all the time. It just grieves me that we've created this technology that chains people to dark rooms in front of glowing screens all the time instead of getting out and doing things in the world. So what I find so compelling about the camera phone and mobile devices in general is you have all this power of technology and you can use it and go somewhere and do something and interact with people in a real personal way rather than just in this virtual way.
The group that I'd followed had used their camera phone to upload pictures and to check their points, but they hadn't looked at the pictures the other groups were taking. Schwartz said, that's the way people look at their phones.
They see the camera phone as a camera and a phone, and they forget that it's also a display that has this persistent connection to the internet, to everything that's out there, all the photos that they've ever taken that are up on the web somewhere, and all this information. And so, the camera phone is really three things. It's a capture device, it's a communication device, and it's also a viewing device.
Before sending out a message to call the groups back in for the end-of-night reception, Schwartz looked at the display screen on which he was monitoring the progress of the various teams.
You know, we're sitting here right now, and I'm watching the photos come in, and everyone's got smiles on their faces. Looks like people are doing goofy things and having a good time at it. So that's a success as far as I'm concerned. People are out in the world interacting with it and having fun.
Thanks to Jordan Schwartz and the OSGeo team that let me follow them in their scavenger hunt. You'll find more info in our show notes at OReillyNet.com/future. Thanks also to Brady Forrest, Greg Treffry, Kevin Slavin, Diane Eisner, Chris Goh, Jacob Wilson, and Jason Wilson. Next week, we'll have the sound of the sessions at Wear 2.0. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at Batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.